All right, we're here at the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. This is Chef Tom Douglas coming at you from the Hot Stove Society and many of my other joints here in downtown Seattle, including the 30-year-old Dahlia Lounge. Celebrated our 30th anniversary this year. And, of course, Palace Kitchen and a bunch of our places, all within a few blocks here in downtown Seattle.
And I'm the proud chef owner of Luke in Madison Valley and Lule downtown Seattle at the corner of 6th and Union at the bottom of the Sheraton Grand. And busy these days.
Yes, it's super nice, huh?
Oh, my God. Yeah, January is going to look like an empty runway.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we have a big show for you today. Looking forward to hanging out for a couple hours with you. We're going to take a look at our food predictions for 2020. Have you put some down? You ain't got none.
That's just kidding.
There you go.
We'll talk about some.
We're going to make a dinner party celebrating chili peppers in every course. And it's our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge, which is going to come up at the end of the show, at the end of our second hour. All right, ordinary to extraordinary. And this is something that I think kind of works in backwards. You know what I'm saying?
No, not quite.
The ham sandwich. And I think that, my point where it works backwards is we're used to building a sandwich. Okay, let's put avocado, let's put lettuce, tomatoes, maybe a little slice of onion, blah, blah, blah. And to me, when you take a ham sandwich from ordinary to extraordinary, you work backwards a little bit and you get the most simple but delicious ham sandwich going. So in my mind, the best baguette, right, the best butter, and the best ham. And now you've got a ham sandwich. So it's like it's just the opposite of what we think of sometimes when you build a big fancy sandwich.
I made a ham for Christmas this year, and I have some leftovers, and I actually made sandwiches yesterday. And the way to make a good ham sandwich for me is to, like you said, use good bread, toast the bread on the griddle, and then put the ham next to it with a nice nugget of butter. Make sure you give a nice coloring to your ham, because it's an uncured ham, and caramelized onion. And then you've got a fantastic sandwich with some beautiful Dijon mustard. So you've got toasted bread, Dijon mustard, caramelized onion, and a beautiful caramelized ham that you put in between those two. And no cheese.
No cheese.
No, not when the ham is that good.
Yeah. So this is not a time to use great ham when you're making like a croque monsieur or something like that.
Right. You use a different kind of ham. You use a cured ham for the croque monsieur or croque madame. But uncured ham, I mean, to me, I want to taste that beautiful meat, and especially if you give it a nice little browning on the griddle. Mm-hmm. It was scrumptious.
Thanks for sharing, Chef. Thanks for bringing some for us this morning. I'm all stirred up right now.
Everybody hungry yet?
All right, next one. And I'm not sure what you know about this, but spaghetti is it's probably more American than it is Italian at this point, right? When you think of all the canned products that we have, blah, blah, blah. Right. But when you have spaghetti meatballs in Torino or someplace like that, it's a little bit different than when you have spaghetti meatballs here.
And well, you know, I think the Italians, actually, when they make spaghetti sauce or meatball sauce, they really keep it simple. They don't make it as complicated as we try to make it here. I think here we make it more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they usually focus really highly on the tomato itself.
Right.
And I think that's what makes a beautiful tomato sauce.
And almost always canned tomatoes, right? Sometimes we feel guilty for using canned tomatoes. We shouldn't.
They're not if you use a good one.
They're packaged at the peak of their freshness and their ripeness. And, yeah.
San Marzano or something like that, you know, whole tomato. You just take the juice on the side and then dice your tomato and make a nice, beautiful pan, really hot olive oil, all onions. Throw in your tomato in there and let it cook very slowly. You know, for a good 20, 30 minutes. And in Italy, just like in France, they do. They put a little dash of sugar in there.
Oh, they do not.
Just to cut down a little bit of that acid.
No, they don't. You are
a dash.
Those Italians right now are going to rise up. Take
okay,
your legs
off. I didn't want to blame anybody else. Not the Italian, just the French.
Okay. Well, you know, I find that interesting because you don't find a lot of sweetness in cooking in France where they add sugar to much of anything.
No, but they do to tomato sauce.
But why? Why
because
is that?
Because it's a very high acid content, and they just want to soften it.
Yeah, but why
it
not
down.
Just add a nugget of butter or something like that to tone it down?
Tom, sacrilege. No, just
no
kidding.
It's not
of course.
At all.
Of course.
So a classic marinara, which is another area where I think you work backwards to get extraordinary, right?
Right.
Sometimes people just, as you said, want to add too much.
Right.
To me, a classic marinara is you put some good olive oil on the burner, you lightly saute a little bit of garlic, you do your crushed tomatoes, You just bring it together, essentially. That's it. You've got you taste for salt and pepper. And then right before you serve it, you throw in your basil. And you've got marinara sauce. Of course. It is the simplest sauce going. But there isn't a human on earth other than you that adds sugar to that.
Okay, so we're not going to go from like sugar. Like this is not like a lot of sugar, just a tiny bit to cut down the acid, especially from the can. You know, you get that, you know, canned flavor.
I know. I'm just
saying, Tom.
I guess I'm just shocked. Chocolate chip cookies. How would you take a chocolate chip cookie from ordinary to extraordinary? Let's just say the ordinary one is the one off the back of a Nestle's Toll House semi-sweet chocolate chip cookie bag.
So I would look. I would look in the back of the bag for a recipe idea.
No, you would not.
But then I would make my own.
Yeah.
No, I would say then the chocolate part, obviously, in a chocolate chip cookie is definitely very important. But also the cookie, the way you make it, the way you make the cookie is extremely important. The dough of the cookie. Some of those pre-made packaging over there are a little bit too, not quite as delicious. Uh-huh. You know, you don't taste the butter. You don't taste the, I would make a good butter cookie, simple cookie, and then put some beautiful chocolate chips in there, and not too much, as we've done here previously in testing. You want to make sure there's enough, but not too much. Mm-hmm. And also, serve it slightly warm. I mean, a slightly warm chocolate chip cookie just melts in your mouth like...
Lovely.
Yeah.
We had that big fight here, right, with Robin from Robin, Hello Robin Cookies, about what percentage of chocolate chip should be in the cookies. And
if I remember this correctly, you lost.
Well, that's because we had a taste test, and she made my cookies 5 days before she made her cookies. Anyway, about 25% of weight by volume, I think, is where chocolate chips should hang out. And if you really want to get dicey with it, take out 10 to 20% of the flour so that you have a little bit higher butter sugar mix so that when you cook them, they caramelize a little bit more. So I would experiment with that a little bit. All right, up next is some possible food trends to watch out for in 2020. Will we be part of them or will we be left on the side of the highway? On Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We're back in the Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
And Tina, our producer here, has been on the Eater. You know, I was the poster boy on Eater last week. I've been the poster boy a lot this year, seems like.
What was it this time, Tom?
The food story of the year was my lawsuit settlement. Mm. Boy, they need to get a life out there.
That's not a food story. That's not a food story.
Well, I got sued for the first time in my life. And we had to settle because I couldn't afford to fight it. And so that made the story of the year. There you go. Okay. Hopes and dreams for this year, 2020. What are your predictions, Chefy, for 2020? What would you think is going to happen and what would you like to see happen instead? Or maybe you like what's going to happen. Let's start with, from the Eater article, plant-based proteins.
I'm all for it.
They've been hot and bothered for the last year and a half, 2 years, 5 years maybe, I guess. We've been selling them for a while. You're all for it. Why?
Well, I mean, it's all good because we can't just keep growing 1,200-pound cows. And you know, I think more and more people are going to shrink down their sizes of meat eating and seafood portion and everything. I think the protein need to slow down a little bit,
mm-hmm.
especially in terms of volume. I think more and more restaurants need to start shrinking down their sizes and... I think people need to understand that the plate is made with many different components.
And I understand, but that's different than a plant-based protein.
Well, it's...
I mean, if you are eating the rainbow around your plate, if you're having five different vegetables and a smaller piece of protein, I think that's different. For example, I'm not all for it.
Well,
so I'm going to argue with you about this.
I was going to finish my conversation before you rudely interrupted me. What I was going to say is you got to start somewhere. Going cold turkey is not necessarily a very effective way, as we all know. Everybody goes on diet on January 1st and come back to it on January 15th.
What's that got to do with plant-based protein?
Because it's a much easier, you wade your way outside of the protein. I think the people are much more attached to meat than we think.
Vegetarian is not a diet. I mean, it's not like a something to make you lose weight.
I didn't say that. I was using a comparison.
Everyone goes light on January 1st.
All right. So what I was... But he doesn't want to hear me, does he? I was just trying to say that you wade yourself out of what we've been used to and move into a much more different frame of mind, which is plant-based. You start all using plant and even insects. I know most people are like, no way. But, you know, insects is definitely also another...
Insects. Oh, insects. I thought you were trying to have plant-based sex, and I couldn't figure it out.
Very confusing.
Is that what everybody understood? Because I didn't see anybody going, all right, never mind.
Here's what I would say about what the current plant-based movement and what I don't like about it is that I hate the manipulation of foods like this, right? If I want to eat a plant-based diet, I want radicchio, and I want roasted carrots, and I want all sorts of different vegetables.
Right.
I don't necessarily want an unrecognizable puree of unrecognizable hemoglobins and blah, blah, blah. You know, and it's not to say that it's bad. I serve it in my restaurants. I'm not suggesting that it's bad. It's just that if I'm going to go plant-based or vegan, that's not how I want to go. Right. I want a rainbow on my plate, and I want whole foods, and I want nice grains, and I don't want a puree of God knows what.
I'm with you.
And so, like, I don't want a petri dish from the lab of my vegetables. And that's where I'm having issues with the current plant-based trend, is that it's like anything else that, you know, that we manipulate way past recognition. And so that's my only thing. That's why I was arguing with you a little bit. All right, how about alternative milks? To me, this isn't something that's a 2020 thing. This has been going on forever.
Yeah, it's been going on for quite some time. I don't think they've invented a new milk that I know of for the last 5 years, but yeah, they're making milk out of everything.
Hemp,
which is
almond, soy, you know, blah, blah, blah. I would think it'd be funny to run an espresso bar these days and have to try and figure out which cup you're steaming of almond or, you know, whatever that milk is. It's kind of interesting. How about this one that keeps coming up for me because people keep asking me to join their ghost kitchens or their delivery kitchen model. It's a hot trend around the country. I don't see a ton of dollars in it yet. But these ghost kitchens where basically you have an online presence, an online restaurant, and essentially you're not open to the public. And so these started maybe 10 years ago. David Chang jumped in maybe 7 years ago. He went bust on it. There's tons of new money opening these kitchens all over the country. And I think the trend right now is to, say, open a kitchen with maybe 10 to 15 restaurants featured in it. So the one I've been looking at has 16 350-square-foot kitchens with 16 restaurant concepts, one online presence with all these different restaurants that pop up.
So
none of them are open to the public.
So all you do is delivery?
All you do is delivery. And this one has a centralized delivery with their own drivers and all that sort of thing. But
sounds like an Amazon food country.
Yeah, it does. I just don't see it. It's not working for me yet. I'd just soon have caviar delivered from our own restaurants personally. So it's kind of, to me, it's a little bit like the food trucks. When you look at the food trucks, you know, many of them have turned into brick and mortar, right?
Right, right.
The Cheese Wizards up on Greenwood, Marination, what's his name? Where You At, Matt? Tried to go food. He did the Rue restaurant in Fremont. That didn't quite work out, but that was a big bet that he made there. But so it's just interesting. I'm so curious where the ghost kitchens are going to end up.
It's a very, very good topic. I know it's going to still be a year of trying more of it because I think it's not over yet. People are not convinced one way or the other. I think some people are convinced it's going to be a good idea, but I'm with you. I think it's going to be more trial before people give up or people make it.
Yeah, we'll see. Keto diet, still huge. Still huge. What was the one before keto that everyone was doing, like the caveman diet?
Atkins?
No, paleo.
Paleo, which is a little bit like Atkins, right? Paleo. That you don't hear much about anymore. For a while there, the top five cookbooks out of the top five were all paleo diet cookbooks.
Right.
And these trends tend to have lives of their own.
Well,
and that's both the beginning, the peak, and then the end.
I do believe there is 100 trend for one or two things that stays. So who knows if keto will stay.
How about vegan desserts? So my friend Autumn Martin has her vegan ice cream shop. I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I might even be an investor. I don't even know. Frankie and Johnny's or something, I think.
Frankie and Joe's.
Frankie and Joe's. Would you go out specifically for vegan ice cream, or would you go to an ice cream shop that had both cow milk ice cream, goat milk ice cream, and vegan ice cream?
Probably not. I mean, if I was trying to do a vegan diet, I would not look for ice cream. I would look for substitute to that.
Why?
Meaning, I don't know. I just,
you love a good pear sorbet.
Of course. A sorbet is not an ice cream.
Well, same diff, dude.
Well, no. Hold on. If we're talking sorbet, that's different. I mean, you want to argue about something? This is a great argument.
Let's argue.
You talk about ice cream. Ice cream is dairy, and sorbet is not. So, no, sorbet, absolutely. A good sorbet, I would look for a good sorbet, because there's a lot of sorbets out there, and not all of them are great. So, yes, absolutely. And at the end of a big meal or a decent meal, it's very nice to have a sorbet. It's very light of a dessert and very tasty on top of it. If it's done correctly, it's got beautiful fruit puree. Delicious.
Yeah. I'm stunned right now. I'm stunned into silence.
You're stunned and you didn't make the difference between ice cream and sorbet?
Well, that you wouldn't recognize what I was trying to say.
Oh.
Which was, would you go out for a vegan frozen dessert?
Yes.
Would you do it in a only vegan shop, or would you go into a ice cream shop that had a vegan alternative?
Number two.
Yeah, I would too. But a lot of vegans won't go into a regular restaurant and just eat their vegan option, right? Because they don't want to be at the table.
We have vegan options every day. So,
all right, up next is a dinner party featuring Chili Peppers in every course on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom.
And I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in the hat.
We're here at the Hot Stove Society, and all the Christmas decor is down, and we're ready for 2020.
Ready or not.
Talking about all the food trends, including chili peppers. Because right now, I just pulled out this year's batch of my black bean chili paste that I made, which has got 30% chilies, 30% garlic, and 30% fermented black beans, and I make it into a paste, and I love that on my pot stickers or I use it on all sorts of things.
But so hold on one second, back up a little bit, because I've never made that, so I'm curious. How do you make it?
Well,
you put them together?
It's too spicy for you, chef. It's not something that you're going
to
eat.
Well, let's just say I want to give it to people like you.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have a dinner party, and I'm going to use it in one of my courses, and I'll explain it then. How about that?
Because really?
Yeah, we're going to have a dinner party. And Tina has insisted, because she's swooning over the fact that Mr. Marshawn Lynch has rejoined the Seattle Seahawks.
Oh.
And he is super hot right now. And so she associated that with chili peppers. And here we are inviting Marshawn to our dinner for a little house party for him.
I must say that
welcome back to Seattle party.
Yeah. Yes, and you have to use those chili peppers from in every course.
From
the cocktail all the way to the dessert.
All right.
So
I wonder what Marshawn drinks. We want to make him happy when he walks in.
Well, he was serving tequila to the Raiders about.
Okay, so something with tequila. All right. So, what's it going to be? Chef, you want to start with the cocktail or you want me to?
I'm going to call it you start with the cocktail. We'll call it the touchdown, and then we move from there.
All right. So, we're going to take some of Jackie. My wife grows amazing chili peppers. We're going to take some of her chili peppers, and we're going to macerate them or infuse our tequila with them so that not only when you take a shot of tequila are you going to get the burn from the tequila on the back of your throat, but it's going to reverberate through your nose, and it's going to make you go, oh, my God, that's a hot tamale.
Wait, are you making tamale too? No.
Well, sure, why not? We'll have little mini cocktail tamales.
Like little slices of tamale?
Little gorgeous cocktail tamales with roasted corn and our tequila. And then we're going to have a little bit of a shot glass next to that with some salt and lime juice. So there you go.
Wow, that sounds cool. I think I'm going to make a smoked duck breast with some of that hot chili crisp from China. You know that jar that we talk about all the
time? Mrs. Rouse.
I'm going to use that as a dressing to go on top of those sliced thin duck breast smoked, and then put a little bit of that chili crisp on it with a nice shaved daikon salad on the side. So you have your shaved daikon salad, a little bit of sesame oil, a little bit of white wine, rice wine vinegar, a tiny bit of Dijon mustard, because everything tastes better with Dijon mustard.
Now you've just ruined it, chef.
Yeah, exactly. And then make that into a nice little daikon salad, and then fan your duck breast thin slice, just like a prosciutto idea, and then put the chili crisp right on top of that.
Uh-huh. Ooh. So you don't mix the chili crisp with anything. You're going
straight
up.
No, I just
want
to put
crisp.
Them as a almost like the dressing of the duck breast.
You know, one of the things about that chili crisp is that it's easy to use up all the oil off the top, and you end up with just solid chilies on the bottom.
Yeah.
And this stuff isn't super spicy, but when you get too much, it can hurt.
No, it's. I mean, I'm a spice weenie, and I never hurt.
Never me. Had too much.
No.
Okay.
It's good.
That sounds delicious. I'm going to go back to Mr. Marshawn Lynch because I don't think he eats duck.
But
so he's going to be hungry. He skipped that course.
The beast mode eats everything.
Oh, beast mode eats everything.
You put food in front of him. If it's done well, he will eat it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to cook an oxen.
Well, we need to start now.
A cowboy steak rib. Something like that, right? You know, with the, I don't know if you saw my Instagram post of my rib steaks that I served for Christmas dinner.
No.
But big, I got a rack of ribs in that had the whole bone left on, right?
Oh, nice.
Definitely Flintstone material, which is definitely Marshawn Lynch.
Yeah.
So big bone, you just pick it up by the bone handle and you just put it up. I charcoal grilled it. I had my roast rub on it, charcoal grilled it. And you could literally pick up that handle and just gnaw away on it and make yourself sick with meat, get into meat sweats and oversalt. And so delicious. And the funny part was,
the meat sweat, is that on the side?
No, don't you ever get it where you eat too much steak and you end up with meat sweats?
Yeah. Been there.
Yeah. Tina's about ready to gag right now. So. But anyway.
You never get the plant-based sweat?
What I thought was funny is I was serving these tomahawk chops at my dinner. And I said to the crowd, you know, I think we had 25 people or so. So I'm going to watch to see who takes the meat and who takes the meat on the bone. And just so that I could, I had a $100 gift card in my pocket. The problem is all the women took the meat, took the
bone.
The bone.
Yeah.
It's like I only had one gift card and there's like seven people. All women took the bone and just went crazy.
That's where the flavor's at.
Well, it's not just where the flavor's at, but it's where the fun's at, right? Mm-hmm. It's just something you don't get very often, and it's just really kind of a cool deal. And so next to that, because I don't want to overdo it, I'm going to make a vegan chili relleno to go with my steak.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm impressed. That's cool. Vegan chili. Okay, do tell.
So a pasilla chili, which is a unripe ancho chili, basically. So, pasilla, it's a green pepper. It's got some spice.
Oh, I didn't realize it was an unripe.
The same chili. It just isn't ripened. Yeah. I'm going to take that. I'm going to roast it over the fire, take the skin off, put a slit down the edge, and I'm going to make a mixture of raw cashews with cashew cheese and roasted mushrooms or some other little veggie inside with that. Something that's going to get melted and delicious in there.
Any cheese?
And then I'm going to dredge it in cornmeal, and I'm going to pan fry it and serve that right next to my big tomahawk chop. And I honestly got to say, you know, me and Marshawn, we're tight. You don't think we are?
I didn't say anything.
I know just, you couldn't see that out there.
I barely was
smiling on the radio, but I got to look like I'm full of it. We're tight, man.
I believe it.
Yeah,
two
you
tight and together.
It's totally not true. Anyway, so Marshawn and I are going to eat this chop, and we're going to lift it up by the bone, and we're not even going to cut off. I mean, it's a 3-pound steak. We're not even going to cut off a piece for anybody else.
You're just going to grab it and...
Just going to grab it, and we're just going to eat it.
It's a men's meeting for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I'm impressed by this. They're definitely going to get the sweats when you're done with that one.
Yes, for sure.
What are you drinking
and
with
you
that?
You don't even have to. What am I drinking?
Yeah.
It's Marshawn. It's tequila. It's a margarita.
Okay, you're still in the same margarita thing.
Oh, you betcha. Yeah. Okay, except that I like mine with a little bit of watermelon juice in it. I like a watermelon margarita. Just saying.
I'm sure he would love that, too. For dessert, a couple of choices. I'm going to make a Skittle chocolate cake.
A Skittle chocolate cake.
Where are you putting those chilies?
You make a nice... Hold on. I wasn't finished. Well, I'm going to use a smoked chili paprika kind of idea to put into the chocolate, almost like a mole idea where you get that deep, rich Mexican chocolate flavor. And make the chocolate cake with that and then decorate, of course, the whole thing with Skittles. I think he would be impressed.
Okay, so Skittles chocolate cake. Do you have a favorite flavor, Skittle? Have you ever had a Skittle? I know you are totally lying right now.
I never had a skillet.
Yeah, I knew that.
I've had the other one, the M&M. I'm a big M&M. I love M&M, but not Skittles.
It's just a brand story.
It's a
said you never had one, but yet now you're dogging them.
I'm not dogging them. I said I've had M&M.
I think Marshawn's going to be very happy.
I think what's cool about the Skittle,
I hope
the
he brings his mom.
The Skittle and the M&M, Tom, is you melt them in a pan slowly and you twirl them gently, and you have this beautiful rainbow color on top of your chocolate. That's pretty cool. Put
that's
that on top
extraordinary,
of your cake and
Chef.
Smoke
that's
it.
Extraordinary. Up next, before everyone else tunes out, we're going to get into our fibbage segment. Marshawn and his mom are super happy. They said thanks on their way out the door. And he promises to run for 550 yards next game.
Well, that's more than one field. That's going to be fun.
All right, up next, it's Fibbage on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Let's go. Two thumbs up here in the kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Tom Douglas here.
Terry Rotorua, the chef in the hat.
Stay with us. We've got another whole hour after this, but we're going to finish our first hour with a little thing we like to call Fibbage, or my shortcut name, Cabbage, because we are a food show.
I call it
Ribbage.
Choucroute.
Choucroute, or Ribbage. Tina Knoll, our producer from LARJ Media, is going to administer our quiz.
It's a fun game, yes.
And our first audience member at the microphone is Dina. And Dina, your job, should you choose to accept it, which if you don't, you shouldn't be sitting there, is to determine whether Chef Terry or Chef Tom is telling you the truth or giving you a big fat lie.
Yeah.
Blowing smoke, so to speak. Okay, Tina, are you ready?
I'm ready. Chef Tom Douglas, your first prompt.
I'm first?
Yes. Yep,
okay, now if you guess right with me, you get a Hot Stove Society bread knife by Tom Douglas. He's a really cool dude, and his knives are awesome. It's about a $30 value.
And if you guess right with me, you get an eau de toilette from Lule.
All right, Chef Tom.
She'll determine that,
Your prompt is this.
Okay.
Tell us a time that you hurt yourself in the kitchen.
That I wounded myself or was wounded by a fellow cook, because that's the worst wound I got.
You choose.
So I'm going to talk about the time I hurt myself.
Okay. Tell us all about it. Tell Dina here.
Hi, Dina.
Hi.
I'm Tom.
I'm Dina.
So here I was. I was a young chef at the Hotel DuPont in Newark, Delaware. It's actually Wilmington, Delaware, just up the street from where I lived in Newark. And there was a guy named Jim Irby, and he was my immediate chef. So in the hotel business, they have lots of layers of chefdom. It's like a fiefdom, right? And they always keep you a layer or two under what the job classification you do is, because they don't want to pay you that upper job classification. So, right, Chef?
Absolutely.
He knows all about this. Anyway, Jim Irby was 6'6", big, tall, ex-military instructor, and I was shucking clams with a clam knife. Have you ever seen what a clam knife? And they're big cherry stone clams, and it was my job for the seafood buffet every Wednesday night.
I think this is a lie. Aren't cherry stones little? No.
Are you gonna? All right. Dina's out. You jumped the gun. You didn't even give me a chance. No, cherry stones are actually back there. They're this big. They're big clams.
All right.
So that's the first one out.
All right.
I have my story for another day.
Sorry, Dina.
Okay, Chef, your turn.
All right. Who's next?
Come on in.
My name's Dane.
All right, Dane.
Hi, Dane.
Chef Terry.
Yes.
The worst mistake you've ever made in the kitchen was what?
Well, it comes back in my mind once in a blue moon when somebody asks a question like this. I was apprentice, and I was making pommes dauphines. Do you know what pommes dauphines are? So pommes dauphines is when you have leftover mashed potato or fresh mashed potato and mix it with pâte à choux, which is another type of dough. You roll them into little balls like this, and then you put them in egg wash, flour, and milk. And then, egg wash and flour, and then breadcrumb. Flour, egg wash, breadcrumb. And then you end up with this beautiful bowl.
I wonder why you got fired.
And then you fries them.
Fry them.
Yeah. So that was my job every Sunday morning when I was apprenticed. I was just coming back to the kitchen after my day off. Saturday was my day off. I would grab the train and land right in front of the restaurant. and run into the kitchen, and the chef every Saturday morning, this was a ranch pre my apprenticeship, every Sunday morning he would look at me coming in at 9:30 and go, "Oh, finally you get here." Every Sunday morning was exactly like that. Like, it was pure ranch, but it didn't matter. The train, I couldn't get there before the train. Anyway, so I was making
it's only a 2-hour show, chef.
I was making the pumped dauphine, and somehow I messed up and didn't pay attention. Put too many pumped dauphine in the fryer, and the fryer boiled over, and then all the oil fell on the ground. The worst part of the story was the guy who was apprenticed with me apparently wanted to be a firefighter, because he grabbed the bucket of water and threw it on the fryer, thinking the thing was going to take on fire, which is, if you've never had that happen to you, never, ever, ever, ever throw water on top of a fryer. The thing just jumped straight up to the roof. There was oil everywhere. It was a beautiful story.
Yeah, that's
true or
that's
false?
True.
Yes, it is true. I was trying to make up some more of it, but I couldn't make up any.
Nice job, Dean.
All right, all right. Dean gets a diffuser.
There you go. You get a nice little eau de toilette.
All right, we've been joined by Tina from the audience. Okay, next question.
Never met a Tina I didn't like. Chef Tom Douglas, tell us about a memorable party you threw for someone else.
Oh, man, I've thrown so many parties.
I know. You're kind of the party king.
James Beard, you know who he is?
Yes.
Yes, he's a very famous author and also the original person who did cooking shows on television in this country.
Yep.
Did you know that?
Yep.
Okay.
So, anyway, a lot of people thought it was Julia Child or the Galloping Gourmet, but it was actually James Beard.
Okay.
And I was cooking dinner for him at the James Beard House, which is odd to be in the James Beard House, which is in Manhattan, and actually cooking for James Beard. Super, super weird. And I was making a fish stew. I'll hurry. I'm sorry. Stories take time. I made a soup de poisson, which is a tomato soup like Terry knows all about. But I actually made it with the fish, the white fish. And have you ever made soup de poisson? You kind of puree the fish a little bit, and it becomes thing.
I thought
I was going to be super gourmet and add spinach or ruby chard to it. And I shredded it up and stirred it in at the last minute and did some garlic toast with Rui, which is a roasted pepper mayonnaise, and served it to James Beard. And he threw a spoon down and left the table because it had spinach in it.
Yeah, Tina, is Tom Douglas telling you the truth, or is he making that whole James Beard thing up?
That has to be a lie. I mean, you can't be James Beard and throw down a spoon because something has spinach in it.
Well, it wasn't classic.
Yeah, I mean, it was. It's a classic. Okay.
You were telling the truth.
No, it's a total lie. All right, good job, Tina. There's a bread knife for you.
This knife, thank you.
Chef Terry, tell us where you first bought your first hat, when you decided to become the chef in the hat?
Cincinnati, Ohio. There's a hat shop right, and I never saw it before. I was going there to do a fundraiser on Kings Island for the hospital there, for the kids' hospital, with another bunch of chefs from the Midwest. And I was walking on, I can't remember the name of that street. I think it's called Main Street.
Cincinnati Avenue.
It's got to be Main Street. Anyway, I was walking and past La Maisonette and past a few things. And then suddenly I saw a hat shop and custom-made hats. And walked right in there. And the man was really kind and everything. And he made me a hat and then shipped it to me about maybe a month later. But it was I was very happy to have a custom-made hat. So never happened before. So that's my story of my hat.
Did Chef Terry really get a hat in Ohio?
Who gets a hat in Cincinnati?
I think so.
I think so.
You think he's telling the truth?
Yes, I do.
Damn, I'm a good liar.
Where did you get your
hat? I actually went to that store, but I never had a custom-made hat. And it wasn't
very
the first
tricky,
hat.
Chef.
Oh, that was good. I love it.
Oh, tricky.
How? I didn't know.
All right, Guillaume, thank you so much for playing part of our game called Fibbage Cabbage. Up next, it's our Taste of the Week on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. Welcome back. Thanks for hanging with us during our long break. My name's Tom Douglas.
My name is Tom Douglas, too.
We are going to answer your culinary quandaries this hour. It comes up once in a while that somebody may or may not be able to cook their way out of a paper bag. And so our intention is to burn that bag and get you on the stove and make your family happy. Brittany Bartleben is going to join us for the Baker's Corner. She's the chef at the Dahlia Bakery and Lounge. And we're going to come up with our favorite taste of the week. So many to choose from. I've cooked last week.
A lot of them are going through my head.
Yeah. And, of course, we're going to finish out the hour with our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. And that's going to be an exciting attempt for me to go back-to-back with perfect scores. I'm not competitive or anything. All right. Taste of the week. Chef, you know, it's... the holidays are a funny time. You get stuck in the middle of making very traditional foods, things that you've made for your family year after year after year, that may or may not be delicious, but they're traditional.
That's right.
Right? Or you get, we also cook a lot during this week, not just for family, but our restaurants are super busy during that time. And so you're cooking a lot and making maybe lots of new food. So what are your, to bookend that, I would say I also don't get out to restaurants a whole lot during that week personally.
No, that's right.
So busy catering and doing the cooking school here, and so there's just.
I've been definitely working in the kitchen a lot in the last couple of weeks, so definitely not much time to go out. But at home, we have a tradition every year, Kathy, for New Year's Eve, New Year's Day, I should say, not New Year's Eve, because we're in the restaurant on New Year's Eve, but makes Hop and John's. Have you ever had Hop and John?
Mm-hmm.
Black-eyed peas, ham hock, caramelized onion into the beans. It's a delicious dish, especially when you finish it with a big nugget of butter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, finish the whole thing, make it very unctuous, and some grilled bread, and it's all New Year's Day tradition with a nice bottle of red wine.
So wait a second. Are you saying that was your whole meal?
That's the entire meal, one giant plate of beans and ham hock. We always talk about salad, but somehow we're too full and it never makes it to the table.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's one day. I mean, this is what it's all about. You do one day, and then the next rest of the year, you eat carrots and lettuce. And you stay svelte like this.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, you know, it's just one day.
Well, I think you know how I feel about black-eyed peas, so I'm not going to get into that right now.
Yes, I know how you feel about beans in general, yes.
Generally. No, I love green beans.
I love beans.
Okay, Chef, thank you for that.
Another taste, on Christmas Day with our children, Kathy made waffles. I haven't had waffles. I realized I didn't have waffles probably for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely scrumptious. She finished it with whipped egg white, beautiful whipped egg white into the batter, so it makes it really nice and light and fluffy, and then put it on the waffle maker, and made a... I had some frozen raspberries left over from the summertime in the freezer, so I made a nice little compote of raspberry and maple syrup, and put that right over the... of course, there is always whipped cream, too, vanilla whipped cream. So waffle, vanilla whipped cream, and a beautiful compote of raspberry and maple syrup, and that was not too shabby.
Wow, your kids must have been so happy.
Oh, they were in heaven. Yeah. There was nothing left, for sure.
That's the kind of thing kids love to come home for, is that kind of home cooking.
Exactly.
I had a couple of things this last week that I thought were kind of fun and interesting. One was I had a crab cake class here at the Hot Stove Society that I taught on the 27th, I want to say, of December. And, you know, I wrote a book on crab cakes. 50.
You
50,
did?
Yes, I did. 50 different crab cakes. But I tend to make the same ones over and over again. And one of the things when I do this class is I force myself to make five different ones.
Right.
And then of those five different ones, maybe some different cooking techniques.
Right.
And some different crabs. So this particular class I did, I had a king crab cake that I made into pakoras. You know what an Indian kind of pakora is? Where you take lentil flour or chickpea flour and you make a batter out of it.
Right.
And then you take larger kinds of vegetables like a julienne onion, julienne red pepper. I did some shredded spinach, what else did I have? Oh, shredded king crab, and then you dredge it out and you pan fry it and serve it with cucumber yogurt. So that was that was very different, say, than I also did the classic Chesapeake Bay crab cake, where I actually sent mail order for blue crab meat, which I don't eat very much anymore,
right.
Obviously being out here.
Why would you? You get Dungeness.
Well, you would because it's interesting. The same reason why you would say have king crab from Alaska, even though you have local Dungeness. It's just kind of interesting and fun, and they make very different kinds of crab cakes.
Oh, yeah.
So, but I did the classic Chesapeake Bay, and there's a couple of things that I was reminded of when you're making crab cakes. So if you're ever out there making crab cakes, number one is if you have to buy your crab in the unrefrigerated canned seafood aisle, don't make crab cakes. Have steak for dinner.
Did you say
tonight.
Unrefrigerated?
It's like canned crab. Yeah, if that's what you're using for your crab cakes.
You're better off getting a can of tuna.
You're better off just having a steak for dinner. Yeah, exactly. the other thing I would say is that one of the things that we noticed is that if you buy your seafood from a fishmonger that is worth his weight in gold, then he's going to give you a taste of that crab. He's going to let you smell that crab. You're paying $40 a pound for it. You should be able to have some access to it before he puts it into your shopping bag. And he's paying $25 a pound, so he wants to sell it, right? So you have to be very careful when you're buying your crab. And then, you know, crab is sold by size.
Right.
That's why you see things on it like the Dungeness crab legs compared to the body meat, right? Dungeness crab legs, if you go for a pound of legs, the big, fat, juicy legs, that's almost $100 a pound.
Right.
You go for the body meat, it's more like $30 a pound. So it's just something to be aware of. When you do get the legs and the big knuckle meat, don't break it up.
Right?
Don't
keep
mess
them
it
whole.
Up. Fold your crab into your crab cakes, right? So that's a really important thing. And then the last thing when it comes to a garnish for the crab cakes, if I have a mayonnaise binder, which many crab cakes have a mayonnaise binder, I like to use a different kind of sauce, maybe more acidic. So I make a little tomatillo salsa or something like that to
something
go with
to cut
my,
through that richness.
Yeah, just to cut through the crab cake richness. So,
yeah.
So lots of little tricks that I was reminded of. If you love to make crab cakes like I do, those are some little in-house tricks to make them that much better. Up next, we're going to invite our audience up to the mic or take some questions off of our Facebook page that you've sent in and try and answer your culinary quandaries on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's Tom and Terry in the Seattle Kitchen right here from the Hot Stove Society. And it is time for our to answer some of your questions from our Facebook page, or if anybody in the audience, it doesn't look like anybody here has any questions, so we're going to just jump into our Facebook page and answer your questions. Tina.
All right, your first question comes from Wendy Lagazzino, and she wonders, when a recipe calls for white wine, what kind do you use?
That's a very good question, because mm-hmm. I think it's true that many recipes says white wine, doesn't say anything about the wine.
Mm-hmm.
I think in most cases when it doesn't specify, it's for dry white wine, which means like a Sauvignon Blanc or something drier than that, like a Muscadet or something like that. That's usually what it refers to. It's usually if it wants a sweeter wine, it will tell you so. At least I would put it in. A Riesling or something of that nature, I would definitely put it in. So,
Tom. Yeah, I always use vermouth, white vermouth. It's,
right.
It's herbaceous and delicious and... if you're making a beurre blanc, you want something that's going to, after it reduces down, you want to have some flavor, right? You don't want to just be butter
right.
in your white wine butter sauce. You want it to taste the wine, too. And that's why I like something stronger like a vermouth that has lots of herbs and spices in it.
So. What about red?
Red wine, I tend to cook with what I'm drinking, unless I happen to be drinking something outrageous. But I generally cook with what I'm drinking.
I usually go between something dry. So Cabernet Sauvignon is usually the driest grape you can find around. You could do Malbec, which is a very good dry grape to cook with. But bottom line is when you cook with wine, you're going to usually want to reduce that down a little bit and, you know, intensify that flavor. So you want to try to find something that's dry, not sweet.
All right. Janelle Medima is asking, what's the best way to roast a prime rib with bones?
Tom?
Well, I had my prime rib class here a week ago, and we tried three different ways, right? So we had choice, prime, and Wagyu. We had bone-out Wagyu, bone-in prime, and then for the choice, I did cowboy steaks, which are the big tomahawk steaks, right? I decided part of my class is discovering exactly that. What do you like best? What works best? So in my class, everybody got a nice little slab of each. They were very full at the end of this class. But But what I decided to do was on the choice, which is a generally it doesn't have as much fat, so it's not going to have as much flavor.
Right.
I did that where I manipulated it a little bit, right? So basically I did roast rub on top. I had a big tomahawk steak. I did a hard sear and then finished in the oven. So now I've got spices and all kinds of things going on my least flavorful steak, which is the choice. On the prime, I did bone in, and I did my classic prime rib, which is I smother it with mustard, Dijon mustard, rosemary, garlic, and I roast it on a medium-high oven for 45 minutes and then down to low and slow. And that, I have a nice crust.
What's the temperature, you said?
I cooked to 115.
Okay.
And that's plain and simple. On the Wagyu, which is the most expensive, most flavorful, we just did salt and pepper because we didn't want to mess. We wanted to be able to tell the difference
right.
in the steak and didn't want to mess with it. When we raised hands at the end of our class, people liked the prime the best because they liked a little bit of that mustard and rosemary seasoning on the steak itself. And you have to go super heavy because, you remember, you're just doing the outside.
Yeah.
Right, so I do a little cheat on that. Once I slice it, I make a little rosemary salt and put rosemary salt on the interior of the meat because so often you cut a prime rib and you serve it like this big slab of meat, right? But there's no seasoning on the inside,
right.
Only on the outside bite. So you have to remember to season the rib itself.
Or make a little flavored oil and then brush it right on top of your meat.
Absolutely.
Same thing, yeah.
All right.
But so the direct answer is I like medium heat. To about 115. When you pull it out and let it rest for an hour, it goes to 120, 123 or something like that. So,
and if it's too rare for you, once you slice it, just flash it in the oven for a minute or two.
Or pan fry.
Yeah, pan fry it if it's not done enough for you.
All right. Janelle Tremaine asks, I've been watching Jamie's Quick and Easy Food. He's the British chef that's been on the Food Network. I've seen some of his recipes call for double cream. What is this, and what is the equivalent to what we have here in the U.S.?
I think it's the same as creme fraiche, right? I think it's what they call double cream. I'm not quite sure. I think it's an English term.
I would guess that it's heavy whipping cream. So, like,
right.
Typically, if you think about milk, it's about 4 to 5% butterfat in milk, whereas 2% is obviously 2% butterfat, and all you got to do is water it down. That's exactly what they do. They
right.
they don't they just add water to the 5% milk to get to where they want to be. Whereas whipping cream is anywhere from, I want to say, 30 to 40% butterfat. And so when you say double cream, my guess is he's saying the very same thing.
All right, your next question comes from Jeanette Harris. She says, I made duck breast tonight for dinner, and she followed a New York Times recipe.
I love you, Jeanette.
Yeah, what time is dinner?
I just don't think people cook duck breast enough. It's awesome.
Well, yeah. She made a mistake or something. She says her duck is chewy. So she's wondering what could she have done wrong? So is it a matter of the duck being just like the way that is, or could she have made
a
mistake?
It could certainly be the duck itself. So what we're used to seeing in our grocery stores is called Pekin duck, P-E-K-I-N, or Long Island duckling. It's farmed almost exclusively in Arkansas and brought it into the marketplace
far
around
away
the country.
From Long Island.
It's what you see hanging in Chinatown in the barbecue windows. It's all Pekin duck. Which is different than P-E-K-I-N-G duck, right? That's a style of preparation. But the breast off of that duck, in my opinion, Chef, it just isn't very tender. And if you're going to do that rare
duck... It's very thin. It's meant to be stay on the bone and roast whole.
Roast well done, too,
I would say.
So if you want to do duck breast that I think that she's wanting to do, Muscovy duck breast is the way to go. And they can be all the way up to a pound a piece. They can be huge. And I like them. I season the outside. I do a little crisscross on them. I think I learned this from you in your kitchen.
Yeah.
And then put some fresh thyme on it. And I pan sear skin side down until it's almost rendered but super crispy. And then I turn it over into the hot pan. And at that point, it only needs a minute of sauté. I turn the fire off and let the residual heat warm that duck all the way through the center because you want to serve it rare. So we've cooked it 3/4 of the way on the top, on the skin side, and turn it over that last quarter, just kind of giving it a quick sear and a warm through. And then you slice that, you serve that with roasted celery root, or you do all sorts of things with
that,
right?
So another thing is you want to try to make that duck not too thick. You don't want to, you know, take the breast and just do 2 pieces of breast and no slices, because that will seem a little bit tough also. It's a pretty tight meat. The fat is all on the outside. The meat inside is pretty... you know, there's no lean, no marbleization or anything. So you want to make sure you don't slice it too thick. But if she has a tough Muscovy duck, I mean a tough duck breast, it's probably because she's not using the right duck breast for that.
I would agree. All right, that's it. I hope that your duck in the new year is as awesome as mine was last year. All right, it's time for the Baker's Corner with Chef Brittany Bartleben, who's going to come across the street from the Dahlia Bakery, Dahlia Lounge, and join us right here in the hot seat on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We're back in the kitchen. We are happily joined by Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery / Lounge. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having
me. Brittany.
Hello.
That's the chef in the chapeau over there telling lies earlier about where he got his first hat that made him the chef in the hat. Have you forgiven him yet for that story? No, he got it right.
No, he got it wrong.
He got it wrong. That's right. We have a new thing, Brittany. I don't know if you've heard it because you come to our show a little later, but we have a thing called Fibbage Cabbage, which is... Tina asks us questions about our life, and we answer, and our audience member has to determine
ooh,
if we're
fun.
Lying or telling the truth.
Ooh, I like this.
And they win prizes.
Oh.
So that's at the end of the first hour every week now, so just so you know.
It's easy. All right. If you don't want to give prizes.
When did you start this new thing?
Today.
Today? Okay, I was going to say, I have not heard this yet.
Last week.
Anyway, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm still drinking hot tea. I have a bit of a frog in my throat.
You sound a little froggy.
Yep.
Yeah. It's the season.
It's a nice change. Normally it's me.
Are you taking a deep breath right now, or are you getting in tune for the new year?
I'm getting in tune for the new year. I took a deep breath over the last 5 days around Christmas, and I'm back to work today, and now it's just back into the fray for New Year's at the lounge. And then I'll have a 2 or 3 month deep breath.
What are you looking forward to in 2020? Are there new trends in baking? Are there new ingredients that you want to try out?
Yeah, there's a lot going on in 2020. I think the biggest food trend we're seeing, and it is working its way into the baking and pastry world, is plant-based. Mm-hmm. You're seeing it more and more. It is my personal 2020 professional goal to embrace plant-based baking, but not so much... where we're using a lot of weird replacers or soy margarine or things that don't necessarily taste good. There's a lot you can do where things just happen to be plant-based. There's a lot of products on the line right now with the Valrhona Inspiration line. These are... It's chocolate, but it's not chocolate. It's cocoa butter, and they mix it with freeze-dried raspberries or strawberries or yuzu. So it's a completely vegan product that behaves like chocolate. Mm-hmm. So that's a really great place to start.
So do you know much about it scientifically? How does the freeze-dried strawberry replace what?
It doesn't replace anything. They're just mixing it with cocoa butter. And so you get these little pistoles.
So there's no cacao in there?
No cacao. So it tastes like strawberry and white chocolate. And the strawberry flavor is intense. I mean, I played with it a bit last year. They also have an almond version. They've got the pecan one is to die for. It tastes like pralines. They've just introduced a yuzu one, which is also incredible, a little expensive, so we're going to use that sparingly. But it's super delicious, and, you know, you can pull off a wonderful sherbet or sorbet or something that tastes like an ice cream that doesn't have any of these cow milks or animal milks in it. Mm-hmm. Speaking of milks, there's also nut milks are really... Everybody knows that's a thing these days, and I intend to start playing with them after seeing Brock Johnson's cashew yogurt tzatziki at the lounge. It is just... Yeah, his falafel last year, I got pretty addicted to it. Completely vegan entree. Super delicious. So it's time to match that with some desserts.
That's exciting.
Cool. I'm excited about it. My son is not plant-based but can't have dairy or eggs, so it's already sort of a natural interest for me. So, yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah. So let's get back to eggs then, because that to me is one of those ones like, what the heck?
What do you do?
Yeah, about eggs.
Yeah.
So you must know.
Yeah, you can make a flax egg, and I don't have the exact conversions in my head right now, but it's something like a tablespoon of flax and some water.
Flax oil?
Just flax seeds.
Flax seeds.
And water, and you just blend them up and let it sit for a minute, and it's sort of this gloopy egg consistency, and it will replace eggs.
It leavens just like eggs?
It doesn't leaven, but it, for instance, in a brownie, it's the perfect egg replacer. It gives it that
unctuous
in a cookie or brownie or something like that. Yeah, so you're still going to have to add leaveners. So that's one place
so
to
leaveners
start.
In that case would be
baking soda, baking powder, yeah, exactly. Okay. And then we've talked about aquafaba on the show before. So that's basically any can of beans comes with a free egg. So yeah. You just drain those beans, and the liquid left behind will whip up like meringue. So that's kind of cool.
That is weird.
Isn't it? Do they sell that liquid?
They do not yet, but I with the whole Impossible Foods line, I think there's going to be a lot coming our way as far as that goes with the eggs and things like that. They haven't worked their way into poultry yet, but right now they're focusing on beef. But yeah, I think eggs are next. Also, the nut milk ricottas, they're delicious, absolutely delicious. You don't miss the dairy. Right. So as a diehard dairy fan, the fact that I'm saying this is a big deal.
Yeah. So in a ricotta, you simply heat your milk and add some rennet to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got ricotta cheese.
Exactly, yeah.
What do you do with a cashew milk or an almond milk?
I am not sure.
Oh, okay.
You'd have to ask the good people at Kite Hill Farms, or it is something I intend to play with. I just haven't gotten there yet.
Okay.
What about butter? I mean, I kind of like my butter on my baguette.
You can't replace butter, like smearing butter on a piece of bread and sprinkling. That's where you have to have the indulgence and have the butter.
I'll do a plant-based with butter.
Yeah. Okay. I'm seeing coconut oil used a lot, coconut milk as well, which is really rich and in a baked good. It's delicious. So, yeah.
Yeah, the problem is it tastes like coconut, not like butter.
Yeah, I think with coconut oil, it's not as flavorful as, say, coconut milk. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're using with chocolate or something that's going to cover up that coconut flavor. If you don't want coconut flavor, I personally love a little coconut flavor, so I don't mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, what I replace butter with is brown butter.
Brown butter.
Yeah.
Very smart move. And you don't even miss the butter.
No. My daughter was making her famous brown butter Rice Krispie treats this
Yum.
Year in my kitchen while I was trying to be serious about cooking. And she was melting marshmallows with brown butter and sea salt.
And it was pretty good,
pretty
wasn't
darn
it?
Good,
yeah,
yes.
Pretty seriously good.
Yeah. And I was trying to think, when was the last time I sat down to a bowl of cereal, like Rice Krispies or Corn Flakes or something? It has been
forever.
40 years, I bet.
Yeah. I don't think I've eaten a bowl of cereal either.
Grew up on that stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's plant-based. Lots of other trends we're seeing. Fermentation, I think, is sort of going to be a bigger thing.
In desserts.
We're seeing, like, sourdough, for instance. Sourdough starter being added to a batch of blondies or a batch of cookies. So I have never done that. I do have a little sourdough starter in my possession. So I will be playing with that.
Do you feed it every day?
Yeah.
Almost.
Truth or false?
False. Absolutely
well,
false.
How come it doesn't die if you don't feed it?
Well, it takes more than a few days.
Yeah, you can do it every couple of days.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
You could even, like, 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
Oh, I might start one then. I thought it had to be done every day.
No. If it did, I wouldn't have one.
I know.
Yeah. what else? Vinegars. You're seeing a lot more vinegar being used, and I'm super into this one.
You mean I was ahead of the curve?
You were ahead of the game, buddy. You're a hipster.
I stopped making vinegar thinking nobody cared.
But just having it be a more of a forward flavor or a highlighted flavor, for instance, a sherry vinegar caramel or something like that. So I'm super excited to play with that. Grains.
It's fun to play with those in pastries, actually, because you know, the mixture of the sweet and sour is very, very much part of our culture now. And I think it's very, people love that. You know,
for years, I've depended on anytime something just was laying flat on my palate, a little apple cider vinegar and citric acid. That was always my go-to. A little bit of those two ingredients in the end and, say, an apple marmalade or something would just come alive. Obviously, apple cider vinegar is something I've always kept handy, but I look forward to, you know, expanding my
collection. I think over the year, I've made vinegar with just about every berry that is in the Northwest.
Yeah.
Appleberry, blueberry, raspberry, blackberry. I've made every vinegar. And herb from my garden, I've made rosemary, I've made thyme, I've made bay leaf, all those different herbs that are so easy to make. You know, just put it with wine and let it do its thing.
Yeah. And all of those things would be beautiful in desserts. So,
you know what I had today that's very apropos for the season? Was right downstairs at Lola before the show, I had toast with quince jam.
Yum.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't jam as in what we're typically seeing with jam, like overly sweet, pasty kind of jam. It was more like a reduced relish. And I know you probably didn't make that. It's probably out of the Westlake pastry kitchen. But it was super good. Mm-hmm. And I was concerned that it was not going to be quince enough for me. And it was totally right there. Just like Membrio but not thick like that, you know, right. But it was more of a, like I said, a little relish. And I think I like that. I think that that's so much better than having that big sweet hit on a piece of toast.
Yeah.
Where you're overwhelmed by sugar.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, to me, jammy toast is as good as any pastry in the world on mm-hmm. a nice piece of bread, but it can be a bit sweet. So, yeah.
I got one of those very funny gifts for the first time this year. On December 1st, the 24 days of Bon Maman jam. It's like a calendar.
Yep.
You open every day, you open one, and it's a little jar of Bon Maman.
Thing. One of my bakers got one of those, and she would bring it in every day. Oh, today we're having apricot. Yeah, yeah. It's so cute.
It's very cool.
Yeah. That's such a cute idea.
Yeah, that's a great idea, especially since the chocolates in those regular ones are disgusting.
And so, most
yeah.
of them yeah. are spread. Yeah. They're not the pure jam. They're spread because it's easier to put in a
yeah.
one-off jar.
Yeah, and then you're left with adorable little jars.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
To do what with?
To throw them away next year when you get the next batch.
Ah, okay. All right. Thank you for sharing your 2020 vision for the pastry department. Will you stay with us and
absolutely.
Get crushed in the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia?
Got it.
Okay. Like that, Chef. I hope you're going to crush her because I'm not feeling it. I'm not feeling it today.
I'm scared.
Up next, Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. And we're back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show. Time for Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia. Tina Knoll, our producer from Large Media, even though you're small, you are from Large LARJ Media.
Yeah.
And you produce our show every week and for the last 15, 17, 18 years, whatever it's been.
Yes, I very much enjoy what I do here on this radio show. Today, we are doing our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge. The way this game is played is I will give you each five questions. Whoever gets the most correct is obviously the winner. Whoever gets the least amount of answers correct is the loser, and that person has to give something away, some wonderful prize, to someone who loves our show. Today you'll be playing for Carrie, who is here in our audience, and she crocheted these beautiful washcloths for us.
Yes, she did. So, thank you so much,
thank you.
Carrie.
That was very kind.
Nice,
Carrie,
and you're still making
more. I mean, I'm not at all unthankful, but I'm a pretty big dude.
Yeah, you have two. This is for his little pinky.
No, she just did these right while she'd been watching the show.
I know, it's crazy.
So lovely. Oh, okay. Yeah,
all right.
Very pretty. So sweet. So, Chef Thierry, should you lose today, what will you give to Carrie?
Have you been to Luc or Lule? All right, we're going to get you to brunch at Luc.
Lovely.
In Madison Valley on a Saturday or Sunday.
Brunch for two at Luc.
Brunch for two.
Beautiful. Chef Brittany Bartleben, what would you give away to Carrie?
I'm going to do a $100 gift card to the Dahlia Bakery.
Nice.
Well, that's a wonderful gift.
Yeah.
All righty.
I'll get you a piece of pie or a couple of
croissants. Chef Tom Douglas, if you lose the quiz today and you don't get a perfect score like you did last week, what will you give away to Carrie?
I'm glad you reminded me of that perfect score last week. I'd totally forgotten about that.
You had forgotten, hadn't you?
I'm going to give away dinner for two, $100 value at the Carlisle Room, since we've been talking so much about vegetables and what's going on in 2020. And that'll prove my point that manipulated vegetables aren't necessarily the future. Vegetables are the future.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Delicious.
Mm,
all righty. Who would like to go first today?
Oh, I'll start.
All right, Chef Thierry, your first question. A white wine noted for aromas of cut grass, fresh green herbs, and asparagus is a what?
Sauvignon Blanc.
You had options and you didn't even need them. Didn't need the multiple choice.
I know.
So good. What's the film that forms on heated milk? You have some options. Do you want them?
Sure.
Is it fat globules, carbohydrate molecules?
No.
Coagulated proteins or lactose?
I'm going to go with the third one.
Coagulated proteins is the answer. Good job. Your third question, Chef Thierry. Japanese eat this food for good luck on New Year's. Is it udon noodle soup, red snapper, spam, or sushi rice wrapped in real gold?
I'm going to go with the spam. Just because I like the idea of Japanese people eating spam.
Sorry. The answer is red snapper.
Okay.
All right, question number four for you. Where is barbecue made with a vinegar-based sauce? Is it in eastern North Carolina?
Yes.
Yeah, That's correct.
Nice. That's because we had that last week.
Yeah. Did we?
No, it's because there's only two types of barbecues that I learned in America, and vinegar is from Virginia, Carolina, and...
He gets two for that.
Oh!
So smart.
Oh,
you're
two.
So smart.
Look at that. Oh, that was easy. Excuse me?
Kansas.
Yes. Well, I wasn't finished. She just gave me 2 points. I want to get another point later.
Well, Texas and Alabama and Tennessee would all be happy to know you think there's only two kinds of barbecue. In the United States.
Where is Texas?
Yeah.
All right, Chef, your last question. Very often, leftovers that are reheated need additional seasoning. However, you should never add more what?
Salt.
You had options. You did it again. Nicely done.
Well, I mean, if you add salt to a reheated item, you're probably going to have way too much salt.
A great showing, Chef Rotaro. 4 correct answers.
Thank you.
Brittany Bartleben.
Competition
tough.
Is fierce today.
It's fierce competition. Chef Brittany, which of these is an emulsion? Scotch whiskey, V8 juice, milk, or olive oil?
Milk. Milk. It's milk. Milk.
She's right. It's milk. Brittany, question number 2 for you. In a restaurant guide, this restaurateur and food critic said, steer clear of dishes disguised with French names that don't mean a thing in a Midwestern hotel. Who was that? Was it Duncan Hines?
That's good advice.
Mrs. Isabella Beaton, James Beard, or Lucius Beebe?
I've heard of 2 of those people. Let's go with James Beard.
The answer is Duncan Hines.
Really? Oh, wow. I never didn't think that was an actual person.
Me neither. I didn't either. Question number 3. Hops are used in brewing primarily as a source of what? Alcohol from fermentation, flavor, sugars, or resinous oil?
Flavor.
Correct.
Yes.
All right, Chef Brittany, which peppercorns are not really pepper at all? White, green, pink or red, or black?
Green.
Pink or red. Pink or red is the answer.
I love it.
2 correct, 2 incorrect. Your last question. On Seinfeld, Kramer and Jerry are attending a surgical procedure when Kramer drops a candy into the open body cavity of his friend. What was that candy? Was it an M&M, Junior Mint, Pez, or an Altoid?
Let's go Junior Mint.
Correct.
Yes. Yay.
Good job, Brittany. 3
Thanks.
Correct answers. 4 is the number to beat. Chef Douglas, you need all 5 of these correct answers in
Good
order
luck,
to win
Mom.
This quiz.
Thank you so much.
All 5. You ready for it?
Got it.
All right. Italians produce a sweet concentrated dessert wine from...
Vinsanto.
Dread... Great... That is correct, Chef Douglas. You are off to a very good start. What butter do professional chefs most often use? Salted, unsalted, whipped, or most chefs use margarine?
Well, Chef Rotaro uses margarine, but I use unsalted.
Correct. 2 for 2. Question number 3. A menu direction calls for a tomato con casse.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do to the tomatoes?
Dice them up.
No, yeah, okay, that's correct, actually. 3 correct.
All of the above.
You
is
are
what
doing
meant.
Very well. Why does the pressure cooker cook foods faster?
Because it's under pressure. Duh.
That is for real.
Well, that's actually not an option.
Okay.
Because same effect as crop circles is one option.
Yeah, that's...
Is it because pressure causes food molecules to burst? Does it create miniature thunderstorms? Or is it the steam that conducts heat better than air?
Boy, I'll say the last one, steam.
Wow. 4.
Wow.
Or this one is going to get you. What do you know if a brine is a salty... Oh, sorry.
If it floats. Is that true or not?
I quit. 5 for 5, Chef Douglas.
Thanks, Carrie. Thanks for the washcloth. It'll do my fingers nicely. If you want to be part of our show like Carrie, you can join the community on Facebook or Twitter, or join us right here at the Hot Stove Society for only $20. It's comes with breakfast. Our show is produced by our friends at Large Media. That's L-A-R-J Media. And our sound engineer is Sean. Don't call me Del Torre. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the Seattle Kitchen on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening.